I'm so glad to see students from previous classrooms here. One of the beauties of teaching people who then go on out in the world and achieve great things is that even if you embarrass them by cold calling them in the classroom or gave them a grade that they thought was not up to what they deserved, time passes, they mellow, they forgive you. All those things. Welcome back. It's so wonderful to have you. Last night I was at the Supreme Court giving a lecture on Magna Carta. As Paul suggested, I will be speaking about that some in the next few months. And came back from Washington this morning. I talk about 50 years at the law school. It's actually, mathematically speaking, a much easier charge because then I had to cover 800 years and here 50. I actually don't quite remember the events at Runnymede in June of 1250. Some of my students may think I was there, but actually I was not. Paul mentioned the fact that after I came back from Oxford and took my degree here, that I went to Washington and clerked for Justice Black. The story is an interesting one because in my law school days, I never applied for a clerkship. We didn't have a culture of clerkships. We do now. Very common. Our graduates go out to clerk for some of the finest judges in the country, but in those days we didn't talk very much about that. I went to work for Covington and Burling in Washington, and while I was there, my best friend from law school, John Rhinelander, former editor-in-chief of the Law Review, was clerking for Justice Harlan at the Supreme Court, and I would go up and have lunch with him at the court, and he was having such a wonderful time, I said, you know, maybe I ought to apply for a clerkship. So I applied and got some interviews with several justices, and to my ever-enduring gratitude, Justice Black offered me a job. Well, then history played a wonderful role because between the time I accepted the job and the time I reported for work with Justice Black, Felix Frankfurter had a stroke and left the bench. Arthur Goldberg took his place and the court tipped to the more liberal side. So Black, after 25 years of writing dissents, was suddenly writing the law of the land, the majority opinions. And I was at his elbow. And I was working hard enough not to realize just how historic that was going to be. But looking back on it, I realized that was the heyday of the Warren Court. Those were the great moments I worked with Black on, Gideon versus Wainwright, and some of the cases that will always be in the case books. So I'm not going to talk this morning about 50 years of the Supreme Court. The Virginia Law Review is kind enough to make copies of an article that will be in print shortly there in the back of the room on how the Supreme Court has changed in those 50 years. But what I want to talk about is some reflections on what has happened here at the law school during that time. Some of you will remember Charlottesville in 1964. It was not what it is today. It ended at Barracks Road. Beyond that point was Sylvan Wilderness. It was a lovely drive. Do you remember what it was like? And there was really nothing. Well, today it looks like Fairfax County. We were a town of, I don't know, 30,000 people perhaps then, maybe another 30 in Albemarle County, and there's probably, 150,000 people in the metropolitan area now, so we have grown a good deal. The university was small. I think we had something like 6,000 odd students in 1964 in the entire university, undergraduate, professional, graduate schools, all of them. It had a sort of a Princeton sort of feel about it. Well, today we're a good deal more than that. We're, well over 20,000, I think maybe 22,000 students at the university. The law school was an intimate place. We, of course, were in Clark Hall. Many of those of you who studied there will remember your first day you walk in and there are those famous murals. And you're saying, what does this have to do with legal education? Well, you learned over time what it did. We were in Clark Hall. That actually had the happy fact of being close to the Jeffersonian precinct. We felt very much a part of the traffic among the various departments of the school. But we were small when I and Peter Lowe, and I think there were five of us appointed to the law faculty in 1964, and that increased the faculty to the grand number of 22 faculty. Can you imagine? Those were the days when faculty meetings, the business of the law school was done on the floor of the faculty. That's something I don't miss, I have to tell you. We have a grand committee system now. I mean, those days we'd go on endlessly debating issues that committees really ought to. I think it occurred to me at the time, watching some of those questions unravel, that getting the law faculty to agree on something was I don't know, like unionizing a zoo, perhaps. Curriculum. If you studied law in those days, you'll remember that you had required courses through the first 2 years. We had a number of courses then required, which are now electives, like corporations and evidence and federal taxation, trust and estates, a number of things which are, of course, in the curriculum now, but are not required. We had something called a cultural requirement. We called it a cultural requirement, legal history or legal philosophy, which everybody had to take. Students, you'll remember that, if you were here in those days, everybody wore a coat and tie. It was de rigueur to appear in class in a coat and tie. And we did because there were not many women. I mean, a typical class in the 1960s might have had, what, two or three women per class? And they were tolerated. We thought we were becoming very expansive in those days. Well, you will know, I'm sure, that the undergraduate college at the University of Virginia did not admit women until 1970. And then only because a federal judge told us to do it. So those were different times indeed. Well, when I started teaching, this was an age when the Legal Academy indulged the amiable fiction that any law professor could teach any subject. And so we did. Now, I taught constitutional law, having been at the elbow of Hugo Black. I thought I knew a little bit about constitutional law. But basically, otherwise, you just taught what was needed. And so they handed, I who had never been in a trial courtroom, I'd done appellate work, I who had never been in a trial courtroom was given the law of evidence. Think about it. You know, what did I know about the hearsay rule or things like that? So, but what saved me was that UVA students are civilized and cordial, and they knew I didn't know anything about the subject. I was a chapter ahead of them in the case book, but they were very tolerant of me. I learned a little evidence, by the way, on that course. I resorted to gimmicks. I remember one day, some of you will know Coach Worth Pinckney from Richmond. He was in that class, that first class I taught. And so one day I said, Mr. Pinckney, I want you to go home tonight and read Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Students were kind of looking at me, kind of fun. What is the professor up to? Well, he came in the next day, and I said, I want you to come in and tell the class what it has to do with evidence. Well, he came in prepared to recite Mark Antony's speech to the Romans from the steps of the Capitol. And that's the one where he holds up the bloody tunic and says, you know, Brutus's envious dagger and all that sort of thing. Well, he came in dressed in a toga. He really got into it. And since he had to play Mark Antony, he said, you, the professor, have to play Caesar. Well, Caesar's dead at this point, right? So it's a non-speaking part. So he laid me out on the desk, covered me with a shroud, and proceeded to orate. Well, it was so funny. The corpse was rocking and murdering during the whole thing. For years, I would run into students who, they might have forgotten anything else that I taught about evidence, but they remembered that day in the classroom, which told me if I'd only had enough gimmicks, they would have learned a great deal about the law of evidence. I decided to be adventuresome and create a course. I had heard about something called environmental law. Well, this is before the first Earth Day, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, all the rest of them lay in the future. They had not been enacted yet. But I had a friend, Dennis Barnes, a chemist. I said, Dennis, let's offer a course in environmental law. He said, that's a great idea. So we offered it. It went into the course catalog. Well, I expected, I don't know, you know, half a dozen eccentric students would come to my house once a week and sit around the fireplace and drink port and talk about the environment. Well, to my horror, 80 people signed up for this course because it sounded like the wave of the future. And I said, Dennis, you know, we have to get serious about this. There was not even a case book. The first environmental law case book was not published until 1970. Now there are 11 case books you can choose from. But those were the pioneer days. Great one. But once again, the students entered into the spirit of it. Now, I was a newcomer, of course, to the faculty. We had giants in the classroom. We had some simply wonderful people. Hardy Dillard has already been mentioned. Those of you who took courses from Hardy will remember his classroom personality. And I can still hear Hardy saying, a word is not a crystal, transparent and unchanging, but the skin of a living thought. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, you have to sort of wonder, what does he really mean? But it sure sounded good. I mean, Hardy could pull it off. And I remember him saying that imagination is given to man to show what he might become, and a sense of humor to console him for what he is. This was, Hardy Diller was truly a thespian. He missed his calling by not being, well, he was on the stage. He was Clark Hall, you may remember West Hall. That's where I taught constitutional law. And if I sometimes seemed to be carried away with the subject, it was because we had the dais and a runway. And so I would parade up and down the runway, and it changes your personality. It really does terrible things to you. So we had Hardy Dillard, we had Charles Gregory, Carl McFarlane, Dan Metter, F.D.G. Ribble, Emerson Spees. I mean, these were some really amazing people in the classroom. I mean, I can still remember seeing students playing Emerson Spees in the annual libel show. He was portrayed as ebullient, enthusiastic, leaping on stage dressed in a white sweater, carrying a tennis racket, do you remember? That was Emerson. Well, those were the days. They're sort of frontier days compared to what we do at the law school today. It is in some ways transformed from 1964. We, of course, have a much larger faculty. We're no longer 22 faculty. We have, I think, about 85 resident faculty, plus over 100 adjunct faculty and others who come and visitors. We have one of the interesting changes, and this tracks Paul Mahoney's comment about the nature of the academy itself, and that is many more of our faculty now have PhDs as well as law degrees. We've become much more interdisciplinary, economics, psychology, history, and others. We have, I think, 15 faculty who have joint appointments with the law school and other departments. So even if in my first days of teaching we were closer to the university in a physical sense, today I think we're actually much more part of the intellectual conversation with the university because of these joint appointments. Interesting phenomena. One of the challenges, the dean would know more about this than I, of hiring faculty is that almost always when someone presents himself or herself as a prospective faculty member, the chances are, if they're married, they will have a professional spouse. And then you have the challenge in a smaller town of finding a place for two people, either on the law school or otherwise. It could put us at a competitive disadvantage on the hiring market, but I can tell you, not on the appointments committee, but the hard work they do pays off in some of the most remarkable young faculty in the country. Faculty scholarship, I think, has also tracked the comments that Dean Mahoney made about changes in the academy, and that is 50 years ago, I think most of the articles being written by members of the faculty would have been of a practical bent, practice-oriented, mainly for lawyers and judges, and today you find much more theoretical work being done, maybe to a smaller immediate audience, but work that one hopes, writing those pieces, will have a long fallout. Curriculum, of course, has exploded along with the faculty. I think we have over 300 courses, is that right, George? Of any taste you want to indulge in the law, I think we have some place for it. I can't talk about the changes in the law school without saying something about technology. Now, this is turf into which I venture somewhat cautiously. I divide the world into two kinds of people. When talking about technology, one of the natives, these are the kids who grew up with it, right? It is part, they've internalized modern technology and they totally understand it. Those are the natives. Then you have the immigrants. Okay, now I count myself, they're the ones not native born, they're newly arrived. Not only am I an immigrant, I don't even have a green card. You know, I'm an undocumented alien in this particular world. And students, of course, you all know this, who are parents and grandparents, the multitaskers. You know, the people who can, while they're preparing for class, they're listening to music, and they're searching the internet for topics of interest. They're uploading pictures to share with their friends on LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever it might be, sending text messages. I mean, all these things seem to go on simultaneously in a way that I can't really keep up with. I mean, this is a generation of people who don't think of cookies and spam as food. These are people who have never had to use whiteout. They've never had to retype a page. Think about that. Well, these are people who've never rolled down a car window. They don't even know what it means to roll down a window. So that's a different world altogether. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine. One of my students the other day told me that he thinks students do about 95% of their research online, especially for legal research and writing, and that they rarely consult books. Now this is, for me, I mean, I grew up with books, obviously, and this is a phenomenon which cuts two ways. The accessibility of the digital age is obviously an advantage. My students are much faster than I would be at finding something specific, because they know where it is. It does have a tendency sometimes to a shallowness that books offer, that you have to sit and leaf through a book. There's a profoundness to the book that maybe the digital world does not offer. And so I figure my job, I've been around here longer than they have, is maybe to remind them that once in a while consulting a book might be a good idea. It impacts the law review. I mean, we now have the Virginia Law Review online. Most of the major journals have that because most readers of law review articles are reading those articles online and not in print. That obviously has some economic impact on the law review, but they found some very skillful ways to deal with that. Virginia Law Review Online, I think, will guarantee an author whose article is accepted to a turnaround of 2 weeks. It used to be in the world of law school or law review publishing several months before your article would finally appear in print. So that's obviously a profound difference. Laptops in the classroom. It's quite interesting to be a professor. It's one thing to stare out at faces and try to read those faces and wonder, are they really listening to what you have to say? If you passed your hand in front of their eyes, would they blink? Or have they learned to sleep with their eyes open? You know the feeling. Well, one reads an article. What is how different it is to sit with surrounded by these row after row of laptops. I mean, anything could be happening on the other side of that laptop. You hope they're taking notes from you. They may be sending email or playing solitaire or whatever it might be. If they are typing furiously the notes you're taking, have they simply become a stenographer? Because, you know, when you write by hand, it's slower. You have to process what you're taking down. So I think it's a fairly debatable question. Are we better off with laptops in the classroom or not? I think we have a fairly laissez-faire philosophy that it's up to each professor to decide. Some don't want laptops, some do, and some are agnostic. The library has seen enormous changes, again, because of technology. I think they were my library friends tell me, concerned about being swamped by paper, digest, and court reports and international publications and all the rest. I think when the current librarian signed on, she told me the other day that they had something like 600,000 volumes and growing, and they were simply struggling to keep up. And from her standpoint, she says that the digital age has actually rescued academic libraries from being buried in print. This is not to say that the library does not still buy and use books, despite the fact there are some patrons who have no idea what a book is. There are, as I've already said, I think an important place for scholarship in the world of books. I think another profound change I've seen in this law school in this half century is that we are now truly international. We're global in our reach. I was at one point the director of the graduate program soon after I signed on. I think there were fewer than 10 graduate students from about 3 foreign countries. And they were good students and did estimable work, but the graduate program was a very marginal part of the law school's operation. Today we have the current year in the law school, we have 43 students from 19 countries, not counting about 17 doctoral SJD candidates, who are not all of whom are in residence. So we have students here from Europe and from Asia and Africa, Latin America, around the world. Our international law curriculum has exploded. When I started teaching, I looked back at the course catalog for that year to see what was a very thin catalog, and we had exactly 3 international law courses and 6 seminars, fewer than 10 courses all told that had anything whatever to do with international law. Today, 50 years later, there are 70 courses and seminars dealing with some kind of international law. So if you want to really take your place in the world of law around the globe, we're clearly doing it. Law school is a busier place than it used to be. When we were in the 1960s, there weren't many student activities. We had 2 law journals, and I went through the catalog to see how many student organizations there were. There were a grand total, including the Student Legal Forum and groups like that, 10 groups altogether. 10 groups. Well, today, walk down the hallway on any day and look at all those posters plastered on billboards of all the activities every day. Some really interesting speakers passing through on some very profound topics. We have now 10 journals, not 2, and I counted 65 organizations. So any interest group that you as a student want to take part in, from serious to more to later, we do it. So a lot's changed. I mean, obviously in 50 years' time, you can expect we are not going to stand still. For better or worse, we move forward or we slide back. The dean has given you, I think, a compelling case that we've moved forward. We haven't stood still where we were 50 years ago. So there have been changes. Now, those are some of the changes, but I cannot be complete in these remarks without talking about what endures. What is still part of the law school that you would remember whenever you were here as a student? First, I would say, would be an enduring commitment to quality education, the margin of excellence that the dean mentioned. I think we are, in many ways, the aspirant to being the gold standard in American legal education. I believe that. Secondly, I think we have a commitment to more than simply law as a trade. We have a commitment to law as a genuine profession, to law's larger purpose. Hardy Dillard, if I can quote him once more, he said, and I quote, "The law is designed to bring about human dignity in a commonwealth of mutual deference." I think that puts it very nicely. Thirdly, I think we are making our mark in our contribution to public life in America. We had, I believe at one time, 6 members of the U.S. Senate from 6 different states a few years back. I know my students, I'm like the typical professor. If my students go on to do something great, I take credit for it, right? Oh, I remember him or her. Yes, indeed, he or she was in my first year constitutional law class. The ones that become ne'er-do-wells or dropouts or steal from their clients, oh, no, that I don't remember him. Must have been in somebody else's class. I have no recollection of that. But my students have gone on to be governors and senators and ambassadors. Mark Brzezinski, for example, presently serving in Sweden. Court of Appeals judges. I haven't won American Bar Association president. I haven't yet taught a Supreme Court justice. 2 came close really recently. Jay Wilkinson, Mike Luttig were on the so-called short list at the White House. I never know quite what the short list really is, but the newspapers, the journalists like to talk about them. They were both interviewed at the White House. And my view was I didn't care what their judicial philosophy was. I just wanted bragging rights. You know, I just wanted to be able to say I taught a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. But I will say that one of my very first research assistants is now the PGA Golf Commissioner. Now, that's big time, I have to say. So I guess the moral is hang around long enough and your students will amount to something. Something else that endures, I think, here that's still a lasting legacy is what one might call quality of life. That this is really a great place, a wonderful place to study law. The Princeton Review this year in its tabulation of the best law schools for 2015 said, best quality of life, University of Virginia. Now, they miss the fact that we're also first in a lot of other categories too, but that's the way ratings are. Students here work hard. They are incredibly productive. I know some of my students are smarter than I am, but I've been at the game longer than they have. You know, I know how to keep the ball moving. I don't want them to pause long enough to sort of say, you know, he's not that smart. So, but they work hard, they're productive, but they also know how to enjoy themselves. I was walking down the corridor the other day, and I saw a young woman, student I assume, pass, t-shirt, which said, "We're not just about softball and beer. We have wine too." So, now, I wish I'd had the presence of mind to stop her and ask her where she got the t-shirt so I could have one myself. Professors have a life outside the law school too. I have to say that I don't spend all my time in the library or at my computer. A few years back, the Boar's Head Inn had a Bacchanalian evening, and they decided that Professor Howard should be Bacchus. So I said, and foolishly I agreed. I went out there for the evening. They then dressed me in a toga, and I had a laurel wreath around my head. And then I was borne into the ballroom at the Boar's Head Inn by two twin sisters, nubile 15-year-old sisters dressed in leopard costumes. Three times around the room while I toasted people and all that. Well, that weekend I had, just by coincidence, my wife and I had some guests from France, a count, a countess, and a princess. I don't usually have titled people under my roof. It's a long story of how they came to be there. But at any rate, they were there that weekend, and we took them along to the Bacchanalian feast. They saw Professor Howard playing his Bacchus bit. And afterwards, the countess said to me, "You know, in France, a law professor would never do that." So, and maybe in America, a law professor ought not to do that. But Mr. Dean, I assume tenure protects me from my follies, if you'll rank me by what I do in the classroom and not what I do with the Boar's Head. Finally, I think that among the enduring qualities is that the sense of community this place has. I leafed through some letters, and I asked I asked somebody in the alumni office if I could look at some of the letters. I didn't want to quote anyone by name, obviously, but here's what a student said to an alumnus who had been kind enough to endow a scholarship. And that student said, "I am certain that you as a graduate can attest to the atmosphere of friendliness, generosity, and sincerity that categorizes this one-of-a-kind school. Here, people genuinely care." I also took a look through letters written by students nominating other students to the Ritter and the Rosenblum Awards. Again, I said I don't want to quote anybody by name, but I'd just like to get a sense of what students say about each other. And here's an LLM student, a graduate student, writing about another student's orientation talk. He said, "The sense of fellowship and brotherhood transmitted by his speech was exceptional. I have never seen somebody take so much pride in his own school." And then here's a student describing her peer advisor. She says, she, the peer advisor, shows a sincere sense of caring for others, a rare thing in a culture of competition inherent in a law school. She is an example I will strive to follow in hopes of enriching the lives of all whom I meet. She is a true role model. And there's just lots of other letters that I could quote from, but I mean, it was just one encomium after another, clearly, genuinely felt. So this, I think, is the heart and soul of what this law school is about. It's one of the things that makes this such a special law school among the nation's law school. We are a community of trust, of respect, of affection for each other. It's an enduring quality. It's something that I found when I first came through these doors in 1964 as a new law professor, and I predict that when there's a gathering here to mark 100 years of law school giving, you will find those qualities still endure. Thank you very much.